From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Nancy Pelosi wins one battle and loses another. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. San Francisco Democrat Nancy Pelosi will be the first female House Speaker, third in line to the president. But her majority leader won't be John Murtha, the Pentagon stalwart who changed the debate on Iraq. Fellow Democrats rejected Pelosi's choice by a whopping margin. On To the Point, will House Democrats be unified on Iraq, ethics, and what they call the new direction demanded by voters? What message will the Republicans send when they choose the new minority leaders tomorrow? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the bid for leadership in a $30 billion industry, video games. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Only, back with To the Point. San Francisco's Nancy Pelosi will be House Speaker, but she won't have the man she wanted as Majority Leader. On To the Point, will the Democrats be unified on the war in Iraq, on ethics, and their so-called new direction? Who will the Republicans choose to lead their new minority? On Reporter's Notebook, video game fans are lined up on the streets of American cities. We'll find out why. First, this news update. President Bush opened his five-day tour of Asia today with a warning about terrorism and North Korea's nuclear technology. He is in Singapore on his way to the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting that will take place later in Hanoi. Michael Hirsch is senior editor of Newsweek magazine. Michael, always good to have you on our program.
Oh, happy to be here, Warren.
What's the message that the president is sending from Singapore to the delegates that are going to meet with him in Hanoi?
Multilateralism squared, I think, to put it in a word. It's basically we, the Asian community and the larger international community, are united against North Korea. They have to come back to the talks. They have to denuclearize. And we're not going to stand for anything less. Whether that message is going to carry any weight is a whole other question.
At the same time he made his speech in Singapore, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, was talking in Hanoi and saying that the upcoming six-way talks with North Korea are going to be pointless without shows of good faith from both sides. What sort of show of good faith is the United States making?
Well, they expect Pyongyang, North Korea, to do something as a show of earnest that it's dismantling its nuclear program. The problem is that there's no indication from the North Korean side that they have any interest in doing that. They consider themselves a nuclear power now, that they have tested a small device. So the talks, which were sort of on again very briefly a few weeks ago, now seem to be in stalemate again.
Okay, so again then, are the North Koreans looking for something more than just the six-way talks? Do they want to have bilateral talks once again? Is that their issue?
That's what the North Koreans have always wanted. The U.S. response has always been, well, we do talk with them bilaterally in the context of the six-party talks, which is the U.S., Russia, China, South Korea, and Japan. But I think, you know, for years now, the North Koreans have signaled that they want to do a deal with the United States, not unlike the one they did in 1994 with the Clinton administration. The Bush administration has said, absolutely not, we're not going to do it that way. And there has been no real movement from those two fixed positions.
Talking with Michael Hirsch, the senior editor at Newsweek magazine, the president also today is said to have tried to reassure America's allies and trading partners that the United States was not on the retreat in the Pacific. Why would it be on the retreat?
Well, Bush in his speech in Singapore alluded to the forces of isolationism, neo-isolationism. I'm not sure what exactly he was referring to there, except perhaps it was an allusion to the desire on Capitol Hill with the new Democratic majority to pull back from Iraq. That doesn't quite equate to isolationism, but I think that's probably what he was referring to. I mean, there isn't really any kind of a movement toward isolationism in the United States. It's not really a viable option. I think he's also sending a message to the Asians very similar to the one that Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, sent when she went there last month, which was basically, look, we're here as the major strategic strategic player in Asia. You don't have to worry about U.S. retreat. You know, the Japanese, the South Koreans, you guys don't have to nuclearize on your own. We're going to be here with our defense umbrella as we were during the Cold War. And I think that, you know, that message has been sent loud and clear.
Of course, members of his own party helped to kill a new trade deal with Vietnam. He's going to Vietnam. That was considered as a significant defeat. Perhaps he was sending a message to fellow Republicans that he wants to get them back on track.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, there is, I think, quite clearly a rather ugly mood on Capitol Hill. A lot of the trade deals, you know, that have been negotiated, not just with Vietnam, but with other countries, have not gotten a good reception on Capitol Hill. There is a kind of neo-protectionism in the air, but I don't think it's going to translate into serious policy objections. I mean, a lot of these WTO deals turn out to be very, very complicated negotiations.
Will the Asian leaders, do you think, be looking, as everybody says they will, for signs of weakness on the president's part since the Republicans lost the election? As I say, that's widely reported, but what sort of signs of weakness would they be looking for?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that we've learned in dealing with other countries is many of them, particularly the more sophisticated countries, are acutely aware of the U.S. election cycle, very sensitive to the nuances of U.S. politics, sometimes more sensitive than our own politicians here. and I think that, you know, they realize that Bush is entering a period of almost lame duckhood here with a Democratic-controlled Congress with just 2 years or so left, you know, in his term. And whenever that happens to a presidency, there is a change in policy. I mean, we saw it at the end of the Clinton administration, where any number of key players like Vladimir Putin in Russia, you know, didn't really want to cut deals with the outgoing president. I think you'll see that more and more as the year goes on, as we head into the 2008 presidential election cycle.
All right. We'll see what happens at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference in Hanoi. Meantime, Michael Hirsch, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Senior editor, Newsweek magazine. In a moment, Nancy Pelosi wins one battle and loses another on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. Democrats were unanimous today in choosing Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco as the next Speaker of the House of Representatives. Once again, number three in line for the presidency. But by 60%, Pelosi then lost her next battle to make John Murtha of Pennsylvania majority leader. Steny Hoyer of Maryland, Pelosi's longtime rival, was elected instead. Still, Pelosi proclaimed that the new majority will be unified.
I wish all of the American people could have heard the discussion of our caucus this morning. They would have heard speeches of mutual respect, regardless of who anyone was supporting for party office. They would have heard speeches of unity for a new direction for our country.
Again, Nancy Pelosi outside the caucus room. The doors, as she indicated, were closed for the voting itself, trying to put the best face on the results. Ruth Marcus is a columnist for The Washington Post. She's been sharply critical of John Murtha, the man who won't be majority leader. Ruth Marcus, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Has Nancy Pelosi been rescued from her own bad decision?
Herself. Yes, and I would like to say I would have liked to be inside that caucus room and heard it, and perhaps they've got a tape they want to make available. I think she has been rescued from... I think she has a bad outcome, having lost her first real moment in the public eye as Speaker-elect, but I think it would have been a lot worse for her had she gotten her way and had Mr. Murtha become the majority leader.
Why would that be so bad?
Because, as I wrote in a column in the Post the other day, we would have had story after story after story focusing on two things. One is Mr. Murtha's background and conduct, not just abscam, but the his sort of avid practitionering of the earmarking orgy that he helped preside over. And the Democrats would have opened themselves up to an argument that they're totally hypocritical, that they talk about ethics reform and then they elected as their number two one of four Democrats who helped stop the ethics reform package they almost got passed in the last Congress.
I think our listeners will remember the earmarking controversy that we've seen over the past year with people quietly inserting enormous defense contract expenditures, particularly into various bills with apparently Mr. Murtha's guidance. But Abscam happened a long time ago. He said he was swift-boated by Steny Hoyer's people when they just brought it up. What happened with Abscam?
I wouldn't say he was swift-boated so much as he was YouTubed. I think he was YouTubed.
Okay.
The new swift-boating. Abscam is an FBI sting operation that stung a number of congressmen back in 1980. And Mr. Murtha was not stung for the reason that he was basically too smart to take this dangled bribe from these very shady characters that turned out to be FBI undercover agents. They were pretending to be representatives of an Arab sheik, and they were offering $50,000 to help the sheik immigrate into the United States. But this videotape that has surfaced of Mr. Murtha's meeting in 1980 with these undercover agents shows him saying, "Well, I'm not interested. I don't want to take money, at least not now. And gee, this is kind of hard for me to say no to. And maybe if we've done more business down the road, we could do it." And these other guys, these other two congressmen who ended up being convicted in the case, they definitely want to be taken care of, and he means financially through money. And so for me, watching this, and I had never seen it before, and the transcript had not been out until it was uncovered by the American Spectator, which is a conservative magazine, but this videotape didn't lie. There he was, it being offered a bribe and knowing that colleagues of his wanted to take a bribe, and instead of running screaming from the room and calling the cops or, for example, calling the ethics committee, which he sat on at the time, he was happy to do business with these guys. And if he didn't want to take their bribe, well, maybe they'd invest some money in his district.
All right. And he was ultimately named as an unindicted co-conspirator in that case. Some people did, in fact, go to jail. Again, we're talking with Ruth Marcus, who's a columnist for The Washington Post. David Sirota is a writer. He's a political strategist. He has been an employee of Congress on Capitol Hill. His blog is davidsirota.com, and he's author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. David Sirota, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me back.
You were adamant before this election that John Murtha was, in fact, the right man at the right time to be the next in line to the Speaker as a majority leader. Why did you think that was so important?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think it does a disservice to the listeners to have somebody like your other guest blather on about how Murtha was the not ethical candidate and Steny Hoyer is the ethical candidate. I mean, that's really a joke. Steny Hoyer headed up the Democrats' version of the K Street Project. He bragged about it on his website. His top legislative staffer is his top corporate fundraiser. He is among the top 10% of members of Congress who earmark money on the Appropriations Committee, on which I served as the spokesman. So it's a dishonest thing to say that one of these candidates is the ethics candidate and the other one isn't. That's a joke. The reason I thought that Murtha should be elected majority leader is because if you take the ethics off the table, if you say that both of these guys are dirty, and you actually look at who's been a leader and who hasn't been a leader on major issues, especially the issues that the election provided a mandate on, then the choice is clear. On the issue of Iraq and on the issue of trade, both of which were the key mandate issues in this election, along with corruption, which we're taking off the table because both are dirty, Jack Murtha has led the fight on both of these, and Steny Hoyer has been part of the problem.
Murtha led the fight. Nancy Pelosi said he led the fight. And let you hear now from the new majority leader, Steny Hoyer. He defeated Mr. Murtha by a big vote. It was 149-86. They were all making up in front of the cameras afterward. Pardon me, here's what Steny Hoyer had to say today about the war and his reported disagreements with John Murtha.
I agree with Nancy Pelosi. Jack Murtha has been a courageous and outspoken leader for that cause. We have had differences, Jack Murtha and I, but Jack Murtha will continue to be one of the most significant leaders in the Congress of the United States as chairman of the Defense Appropriation Committee.
Okay, again, there is the new majority leader. Does that, David Sirota, make you feel any better about where the Democrats are going with regard to Iraq?
Well, it does, and, you know, I mean, we need to remember that it was Steny Hoyer who said that when Murtha came out and provided leadership on Iraq, that Murtha's plan could, quote, lead to disaster. He then ran to the Washington Post and attacked Pelosi for supporting Murtha's position. But I think that, look, I think this is his statement today is a good step in the right direction. And I think one other thing that's important, all the billing of this being a major loss for Nancy Pelosi fundamentally misunderstands how this was a victory for Nancy Pelosi no matter what happened. The fact that she came out and backed an opponent to Murtha shows that there will be consequences. It tells other Democrats in the House that there will be consequences if they undermine the Democratic Party. Every single lawmaker in the House got the message that they could face a similar challenge, essentially pain, if they are disloyal to the Democratic Party as Hoyer was before this.
She lost the vote by 149-86. So how is that a message that demonstrates her strength?
Because Steny Hoyer didn't want to have an opponent. Steny Hoyer was the only member of the people in line for leadership who had an opponent. I mean, this is the whole issue of why do we have primaries? Why are primaries valuable even if they lose? Because they send a message to incumbents, to people who have gotten used to being in power, that they will actually face obstacles. They will face consequences for their behavior. Even if the primary challenge, or even in this case if Murtha lost, every member of the Democratic caucus now knows that if they cross Pelosi, they might have to deal with something unpleasant that they don't want to have to deal with.
David Sirota, again, formerly a House employee, now a blogger for Democratic causes. Back to Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post. I don't think you did say that Steny Hoyer was necessarily the ethics candidate.
I didn't say he was the ethics candidate, and I don't think he's a choir boy. I do think that there are differences between the two of them in that regard. Steny Hoyer was not one of 12 Democrats who voted against the McCain-Feingold bill to end soft money contributions to the political parties. Steny Hoyer was not one of 4 Democrats who voted to kill the ethics package. Steny Hoyer didn't go to the Blue Dogs and tell them that the ethics package was total crap just the other day. And Steny Hoyer has not been the same on earmarking as John Murtha has, nor was he. Did he come close to being indicted and close to being sanctioned by the Ethics Committee
for
his involvement in that scam?
Let me interrupt you and go back to David Sirota. Your book is about how big money and corruption conquered our government. Here's Mr. Murtha saying that the ethics that now we heard again today from Rahm Emanuel, who's going to be the caucus leader among the Democrats, that it's one of their major efforts, and John Murtha has called it total crap.
Well, I think that in the way that Murtha meant it, perhaps that wasn't the right way to put it. I do think in some ways you could say it is total crap because it's not strong enough. I mean, the ethics and lobbying reforms that they have been proposing, at least up until this point, have not been seriously going after the real problem. They haven't been efforts to cut off money from lobbyists to members of Congress. Perhaps Murtha wasn't speaking of it in those terms. But again, I just think that trying to make this who is a cleaner candidate, that's just both of these guys are totally part of the system when it comes to those issues.
Let me go back, let me introduce a new guest to our program, Joe Connison. He's a political commentator and writer, contributor to the New York Observer and to Salon.com. He's also author of the book Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth. Joe Connison, welcome to you.
Thanks, Warren.
You wrote also that you thought that ahead of time, I should say, that Nancy Pelosi was taking a big risk with this move. Here we are talking about who's the dirtiest amongst the top two Democratic candidates to be majority leader. What does that say about the new majority?
Well, I think there are a lot of distinctions that need to be drawn here, first of all, Warren. There's a distinction between figures like Duke Cunningham, the Republican defense appropriator who's now in prison, and someone like Jack Murtha, who has come up to the line, I think, and crossed it on ethical issues, but has not committed any crimes as far as anybody is concerned. And another distinction between someone like Murtha, who has come very close to getting in trouble in the past, as Ruth Marcus said, and someone like Hoyer, who is acting within a system that I think has many unethical aspects, but hasn't done the things that Murtha has done. You know, Murtha's been lobbied by his brother, for defense earmarks. I mean, Hoyer hasn't done anything like that. So I think it's silly to pretend that there are no distinctions to be made. And it's very clear that the members of the Democratic caucus made those distinctions when they cast this vote today. They decided that there was a reason why they preferred Hoyer to Murtha. I don't think it was because of their positions on the war. I think actually probably more Democrats in the caucus agree with Murtha on the war than agree with Hoyer. And which is the reason why I think it was a mistake for people who opposed the war to cast this as an anti-war, a war or anti-war decision by the House. They were going to lose that vote, and it made it muddied the waters on that issue. This was a vote on who the members of the House felt more comfortable with. Hoyer, I don't think you can say also that Hoyer betrayed the Democratic Party. There are a lot of Democrats in the House who feel that Hoyer worked very hard to win a Democratic majority back. Now, I happen to disagree with Hoyer more on, you know, ideological and foreign policy issues than I do with Murtha. But that doesn't mean that, I don't understand why the House members made the choice they did. And it was quite predictable that they would make that choice.
But when the incoming speaker says she wants to drain the swamp, and when we heard again today that they're going to have, I think, you know, the toughest ethics package they've ever had, and here we are having this discussion and having to make these kinds of distinctions, is that simply a commentary on business as usual in the Congress? And can there be any expectation on the part of voters then that that's going to change?
Well, I think in a paradoxical way, this contest may have forced a better set of reforms on the new House leadership than they might have been able to do before. I think now this issue has been raised in the starkest way, and that Pelosi is going to have to deliver on reform, or she's going to look very bad. This has already raised questions about her commitment to draining the swamp, and I think now, more than ever, she's going to need to deliver on that.
David Sirota, back to you. Your book, Hostile Takeover, about big money and corruption. Are you and others who agree with you on this issue going to try to hold her feet to the fire on that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that no matter what came out of this, and I had written this before, no matter what came out of this election, this majority leader election, I think there will be a strong push for real, serious ethics and lobbying reform that goes far past what had been proposed in previous Congresses. Again, I just want to reiterate, I really believe that if you understand how power works in the institution of Congress, you understand that merely having a challenge to Hoyer, not allowing him to walk to that position, was a major victory for Pelosi. That is really what happened here. Remember, Dick Gephardt.
Wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt you because we need to go to a break. We'll come back, let you finish your point in a moment with Joe Connison and Ruth Marcus as well. A little later, we'll look at the battle on Capitol Hill for leadership of the new minority. What are the Republicans going to do? On Reporter's Notebook, PlayStation 3 goes on sale at midnight. We'll talk about what that means for a $30 billion industry on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point, talking today once again about Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats' efforts to organize the House, Pelosi being elected as the Speaker by her Democratic caucus, and then losing by 149-86, the vote to try to get John Murtha of Pennsylvania to be majority leader. David Sirota, a writer, political strategist, a former congressional employee, author of a book on called Hostile Takeover, about big money taking over the government, is explaining to us how this is a victory for Nancy Pelosi. David, go ahead and finish your point.
Well, I think it's a victory that there was even a contest. And what I was saying before was that, look, we lived in the era of Dick Gephardt, where he tried to govern the caucus or run the caucus by consensus. And what ended up happening was, and by consensus, I mean in the worst sense of the word, that it was so consensus-driven or attempt to be consensus-driven that it was paralyzed. Pelosi is a much different leadership style. She rewards her friends, and she tries to punish people who undermine the caucus and undermine her. And I think that what that does is that creates a much more sharply honed caucus, a caucus that's able to do things. It's the Machiavellian stuff. It's the idea that, you know, you want to be loved, but you also want to be feared. And I think by having a contest for this race, not just allowing Hoyer to walk to this position, was a way to instill a sense in that caucus that there will be consequences for undermining the caucus itself.
Ruth Marcus, a columnist for The Washington Post, that certainly is the way that the Republicans ruled the Congress for a good long time after they took over in 1994. Tom DeLay, famous for rewards and punishments. Does David Sirota have a point about how you hold the caucus together?
I can't imagine that Machiavelli, if he was advising Nancy Pelosi, would have said, go out and in your first stab at showing your power, have a high-profile loss. And, you know, after the vote today, Nancy Pelosi came out and said, now let's let the healing begin. Why are Democrats having to talk about healing after just having won this phenomenal victory, taking back the House after 12 years, winning the Senate? Now all the attention has been on their disagreements, when if we hadn't been paying attention to their disagreements, we could have been paying attention to the fight for control on the among the Republicans in the House. It's just lunacy from my point of view.
We are going to hear about that in just a moment. Joe Connison, back to you with the New York Observer and Salon.com. How do you see the future for the Democrats in the House?
Well, I think they have a bright future if they pull together and act on the agenda that they proclaimed, including reform. I don't think that Pelosi can afford too many more victories like this. You know, you cannot punish people or reward them when you're trying to influence a secret ballot. She doesn't know who voted which way except for the ones who announced their votes, some of whom are among her closest allies and among the most respected figures in the House who opposed her on this, and I don't think she's going to punish them. So I think it would be good if they go forward from this and, she acts with more prudence from now on.
What do you think are the prospects for that? What's her history in this regard? Republicans, have tried to paint her as a left-winger from San Francisco.
Yeah, I think that's an exaggeration. I think David is right that she is somebody who wants to run a tighter ship in the House, and I think that's a very good idea. I think the Democrats have been incoherent in the past, and she is focused on loyalty and on discipline, and I don't see anything wrong with that for a speaker. But you need to pick your fights, and this was the wrong one.
What do you think is going to be the next one?
Oh, I think they have to pull the House Democrats together on the war. I think it's absolutely correct that was the main issue in this election, and they have to have a coherent, strong position to face President Bush with over the next several weeks, as the Baker Commission reports, and as I think, I'm afraid to say, the situation continues to deteriorate in Iraq.
Before they start doing business, they're also going to have to appoint committee chairs. Another problem has arisen with Jane Harman of California, who wants very much to be chair of the Intelligence Committee.
I was going to say, again, that's a misjudgment on Speaker Pelosi's part. She wants to replace Jane Harman, which would be fine, except she's proposing to replace her with Alcee Hastings, another compromised candidate, in many ways worse than Murtha for a leadership position. And, she's gonna run into opposition on that. And I'm hoping that she will rethink that and figure out a better alternative.
Alcee Hastings, before he became a congressman, was impeached and convicted as a federal judge. Ruth Marcus, back to you. Is that another mistake, do you think, by Nancy Pelosi?
I think she has put herself in a very difficult box. She doesn't want to name Jane Harman, and she's made it clear that she won't name Jane Harman to this chairmanship, but she now risks incurring the ire of the Congressional Black Caucus if she doesn't name Mr. Hastings, who's next in line. The caucus has made it clear that they essentially insist that he be given his due and moved up to the chairmanship. She's going to take an enormous amount of heat from a whole bunch of folks, including members of the Democratic Caucus, if she does that. So So she's put herself in what I think is another lose-lose situation.
All right. Thank you all very much for being with us. Ruth Marcus with The Washington Post, David Sirota, again, blog davidsirota.com, and Joe Connison with The New York Observer and Salon.com. Good to have all of you with us. We spent the majority of our time talking about the new majority, but we don't want to leave out the minority. The Republicans have issues of their own when it comes to leadership. Certainly they did for a long time in both houses of Congress run a tight ship, the phrase we just heard that Nancy Pelosi wants to impose in the House. Now the Speaker has indicated that he will step down, and there is a fight to succeed him. Horace Cooper is a professor at George Mason University's School of Law. He was a senior aide to the former Majority Leader Dick Armey, associated, of course, with Newt Gingrich when the Republicans took over in 1994 with their contract with America. Horace Cooper, welcome to you.
Welcome, Warren. Thanks for having on.
What do you think the Republicans need to do in the way of choosing a successor to Denny Hastert?
Well, you need two characteristics when you're in the minority. You need the ability let me just say real quickly. Because the rules are such that being in the minority, having fewer votes than 218 means you don't influence the rule, means you don't get to decide what amendments, it means it's very difficult for you to set policy. You can introduce bills, but if you actually don't carry 218 votes, unlike in the Senate where you need 60, bipartisanship isn't necessary. So what do you need if you're in the minority? What you need is a leader who has the rhetorical skill to explain the positions and the organizational skill to keep that minority as cohesively organized as possible so that you can say this is the Republican or minority alternative proposal. That's our challenge.
Now, you have said that this is not a challenge that lends itself to on-the-job training, and you're talking about two of the contenders for this position, John Boehner, who has been part of the current leadership. He's majority leader at the moment, took over for Tom DeLay, and a man from Indiana named Spence, who has a different view. You think John Boehner's the man. Why?
Well, I would argue that both of these individuals are very principled. Both of these individuals are fairly skilled rhetoricians, but it isn't a good idea in this circumstance of being in a minority to not fully understand the institutional operation of the House of Representatives. And in that instance, John Boehner clearly stands head and shoulders above all other alternatives in that he understands. He has served in the minority. He served as a chairman. He has served in two different capacities in leadership. These type of advantages are extremely helpful. Without being unduly negative, I would suggest that just a look at Mr. Frist's tenure as majority leader, someone who had not served either in the minority or had a significant amount of time serving even in the majority, showed that it was a significant challenge for him to act as the leader of the Republican caucus.
Okay, that, of course, over on the Senate side, Senator Frist, again, stepping down from the Senate, but he has been the majority leader, senator from Tennessee. Now we're talking about the minority leader in the House. Richard Viguerie is a longtime conservative activist. He's chair of the American Target Advertising Company. He's also author of a new book, Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. Good to have you back on our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
Is John Boehner one of those who hijacked the conservative cause?
Absolutely. In my book, Conservatives Betrayed, I called, and this was many months ago, for all of the Republican leaders in the House and the Senate to step aside. In my opinion, Warren, conservatives are like the biblical Jews who had to wander through the desert for 40 years until that generation of immoral, corrupt leaders had passed away. And conservatives are not going to get to the political promised land until we have new leaders. I think the leadership that is there is, quite frankly, immoral, corrupt. They have shown that they will spend our children's money, without limit for the sole immoral purpose of holding on to power. And Boehner and Blunt and Denny Hastert are not the type of people who can excite the American people and paint a conservative vision that will build a majority that could govern for generations, and they just need to go and give it younger conservatives, which they are not conservatives, but give younger people who are conservatives a chance to lead America.
All right. We're talking to a conservative who's talking about Republicans here. I should remind our listeners, what about Mike Pence from Indiana and the concern that Professor Cooper has that he doesn't know enough to run the minority under the very difficult circumstances that prevail?
Well, I don't feel I'm comfortable weighing in saying Republicans, because I am so angry at the Republicans that I no longer think of myself as a Republican. In my book, Conservatives Betrayed, I urge conservatives not to think of themselves as Republicans. They've gotten too close to the party. They've become an appendage of the party, and it's hurt them. They need to distance themselves from the Republican Party and focus on their own organizations, their own issues, and push both parties, Republican and Democrat, to a conservative direction. So whoever the Republicans select, I don't know that it's comfortable saying one name or the other, except that they should be younger conservatives who, as Horace said, are articulate and can paint a vision of where to take America. And the present leadership just has not done that, and they're not capable of doing that.
Again, the present leadership represented for the moment on this program by John Boehner, the man who's running for a minority leader. Back to Professor Cooper. Here's Richard Viguerie saying that the people that have been running the House are immoral, corrupt, and devoted to immoral spendings for the sole purpose of holding on to power.
Oh, well, I guess I wouldn't fully embrace that thesis, but I will say that the Republican electorate typically is made up of people who have voted in a way in this last election and consistently have over the last 25 years to hold their leadership, their members, far more accountable than you see on the other side of the aisle, where chairmen, where individual members of Congress, where individual politicians act in ways that are inconsistent with the principles of the organization. On the other side of the aisle, quite often people are given do-overs, another chance, etc. Republican voters do tend to be much more willing to hold people accountable, much more willing to say that if you're not acting in a manner consistent with what we believe, we will. And if you look at the numbers in these last elections, there was only a 2 or 3 point gap between the Republican turnout and the Democrat turnout. But if you look at the size of the margin overall in candidates, a number of Republicans were angry enough that they actually voted for Democrats. So this is extremely critical, therefore, to have a cohesive Republican minority caucus, one that is capable of explaining its visions. When you think back about Ronald Reagan, who came in with a significant Republican minority and yet got a national election mandate, he did two things. He was both principled and he was competent and very skilled at explaining what those principles were. You can't have one or the other. You can't just be a good, skilled person and explain it and not have a principle, and you can't have good principles and not be able to explain it. So I would differ somewhat by saying that it is critical that we do see, if you're going to have an effective minority, that you have people who understand the process, who understand the rules, who understand how to motivate and influence the members of the conference itself, and can effectively do that. And I will tell you, John Boehner left leadership in 1998, and I think the Republican leadership suffered a significant decline as a result of his departure. He is a very, very effective spokesman.
Richard Viguerie, what about GOP voters holding their people accountable? Have they, in fact, done a good job of that?
Oh, not at all. They've been, book, I say conservatives have been betrayed. And how George W. Bush and other Republican leaders hijacked the conservative cause. They used conservative issues, conservative organizations, conservative grassroots activists, certainly conservative donors, to get elected, and then once they were elected, they abandoned them. So what you're going to see, if the Republicans continue to ignore and, in essence, diss the conservative voters, conservatives are not going to stand for this. There's going to be an open rebellion if we put technicians in there, people who know the rules, and continue to abuse their power by trying to hold on to power by spending our children and our grandchildren's money. You're going to see a massive warfare going on in the Republican Party. In my lifetime, Warren, we have taken over, we as conservatives, have taken over the Republican Party three times, 1964 with Goldwater, 1980 with Reagan, and 1994 with the Gingrich-led takeover of the Republican Congress for the first time in 40 years. And that battle, quite frankly, regardless of who the leader is underway right now. We have begun the battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party to take it back from those who hijacked it and governed from left of center. This president has abandoned the conservatives, gave lip service to the social issue conservatives, engaged in nation building when he promised he wouldn't. So there is just a lot of anger and frustration at the grassroots level. And if the Republican Party reelects the same old leadership, they're sending a message to the grassroots conservatives that we don't care about you. We're just going to do whatever we want to do to hold on to power, and we're going to continue to ignore you and your issues.
Professor Cooper, is there a battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party going on?
Yes, but I actually think Richard Viguerie has confirmed my view that Republican voters do hold their leaders more accountable than you see on the other side of the aisle. Republican voters are much more willing to be people who adhere to a principle, and if they say, whether it's no new taxes or whether it's limited government, whatever the principle might be, those Republican voters aren't going to simply accept whatever is given to them as...
So is that what happened in this election then? Were they disciplining the leaders who did all of the things that Richard Viguerie said they did?
A significant number of Republican voters actually cast a vote for a Democrat, and I would say I don't believe it's because they were closet Democrats. It appears that there was a desire to send the message that control for control's sake alone is not going to be tolerated by Republicans.
But you're saying that Boehner doesn't represent that.
And I'm saying that John Boehner is someone who understands that, and in fact, a few weeks before the election, conceded that there had been quite a bit of deviation from the Reagan Republican principles that had animated the Contract with America. Now, he only rejoined leadership in January, and so it became difficult to, in a year's time, undo what had been a regular disengagement from the principles that had gotten people elected, and instead to a policy of let's just stay in power for power's sake. That is not a principle that animates Republicans. The base of the Republican Party is not interested in control for control's sake. There are principles that animate them and motivate them, and those who can express those and those who live up to those will get the vote of Republicans.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for being with us. Horace Cooper, again, Professor George Mason University School of Law, former aide to former Majority Leader Dick Armey, and Richard Viguerie, longtime conservative activist. Conservatives Betrayed, his book, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. The vote will take place tomorrow. Once again, Professor Cooper is supporting John Boehner, the current majority leader, trying to become the minority leader when the new Congress firms up. Richard Viguerie saying he's not supporting any Republicans at this point. We'll see what happens. Thanks again to both of you for being with us.
Thank
you, Warren.
From politics on Capitol Hill to games of another kind, video game fans are lined up on the sidewalks in cities around the country in hopes of getting Sony's new PlayStation 3. American outlets will only get 400,000 of those new machines. We'll have more in a moment on what this means for a $30 billion industry on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
We're only back with Pavoter's Notebook on To the Point. Sony's new PlayStation 3 is priced from $499 to $599, not high enough to discourage the most determined players who are waiting in line for sales to begin at midnight tonight. John Brody is an analyst at GameSpot. That's a computer and video gaming website. And John Brody, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
Are you on a cell phone out there in a line someplace waiting to get your PlayStation 3?
I wish. They wouldn't let me out of the office, but if I could, that's exactly where I would be.
Why?
because this PlayStation 3 for a gamer like me is represents the latest and greatest gaming experience, and it's what gamers live for. This is the moment that everyone's been waiting for years, to get their hands on a PlayStation 3.
What's a gamer?
A gamer is someone that lives for gaming. I mean, someone that plays games 2 to 4 hours a day, and a lot of the friends are actually online playing games with them. And that's who the PlayStation is targeted for, especially at these launch events. The core gamers, as we call them, are the ones that are in line at Best Buy and Target and all those other stores.
Okay, we can see why this has become a $30 billion industry with people who have that kind of enthusiasm for it. What is it about PlayStation 3 that makes it the latest and greatest?
The PlayStation 3 is probably the most advanced piece of electronics that anyone's ever tried to mass manufacture, much less get into people's living rooms. It has processing power that's about 10 times as powerful as the current generation of gaming systems. But not only that, it has a brand new technology for DVDs built inside. It has a Blu-ray DVD player, which is high-definition DVD. So people that love games are expecting just to take their game into an entirely new level.
What does that mean? Is it the quality of the graphics? Is that part of what it's about?
You know, Warren, it really means a little bit of everything. First of all, the graphics are increasingly realistic. So it's a lot of these games now, it's almost like watching a movie. And a lot of people have fun just watching other people play games because the actual images and graphics are so entertaining and intriguing. But also games can become a lot deeper and more involved, so that the idea of these new games is that you really immerse yourself in an entire experience, much more than just simply sitting in front of a TV and playing.
We're talking once again with John Brody, who is an analyst at GameSpot, the computer and video gaming website. I take it that this really is a generational thing. Frankly, I didn't grow up with these, but I gather you did.
Well, I feel very lucky because I literally did grow up with gaming. You know, my first game that I ever played was Pong when I was 6 years old, and so I've actually grown up with the industry. So when I see games like the ones that are out for the PlayStation 3, I am still amazed. The kids today that are just starting the game, you know, they're starting with the PS3, and this gaming is just a huge part of their lives, and it's more important to a lot of young kids than movies or TV or books or anything. So this is definitely something that is hard even for me to understand, the intensity of the feelings, and I grew up with games.
PS3, once again, PlayStation 3, the new Sony console that is going to be going on sale at midnight tonight. What is the marketing strategy that leads Sony, when there's this kind of enthusiasm with people lined up at stores all over the country, to only release 400,000 of these?
This is definitely not a strategy, and it's not the way Sony wanted it to be. They have had a really tough time getting these systems out the door because they're so advanced that they ran into a lot of manufacturing problems. So they had really hoped to have more than 1 million units ready to go tonight, and instead we're stuck with only 400,000. So this isn't any kind of a gimmick. Sony would really love to have more units out there. They just have not been able to deliver.
Well, now we have also Microsoft and Nintendo rubbing their hands at the prospect that these might not work.
That is really a good image. That's really true. I mean, Microsoft got a one-year head start. They released the Xbox 360 last year. They had their own set of problems, but they've gotten into their stride over the last 12 months. And Nintendo is not leaving Sony much breathing room. They're releasing their brand new system, the Nintendo Wii, on Sunday, just 2 days after Sony's release. And they are gleefully announcing to the world that they have plenty of units in the stores and hoping to capitalize a little bit on Sony's shortages.
So you won't have to wait in line outside on the sidewalk for hours ahead of time.
Well, the same gamers that are waiting for the PlayStation 3, believe me, they'll be in line for the Wii as well. It's just that's this is what they live for. It doesn't get better than this for them.
Well, now, why is this a good thing? When kids start out at this at such a young age, you say some of them play games for 2 to 4 hours. It's my understanding there's a lot of them play games for a lot longer than that. And people are saying there's actually an addiction issue with regards to video games. What are your reflections on that?
Well, my reflections are that I don't have kids yet, but if I did, I certainly wouldn't let them play games more than an hour or two a day. And I do think that as games get more immersive, that all of us in the gaming industry, including the publishers, have a responsibility to make sure that what we're putting in front of the kids buying our games are, you know, overall good experience for them. And speaking to that point about the games and the content in them, Nintendo is kind of trying to tackle this with their system, the Nintendo Wii, because that system is focused much more on family, casual games that the entire family can play together. So I think you're going to see Nintendo pressuring the industry a little bit to ratchet down some of the violence and sex we've seen lately, which I don't think in the long run is a good thing at all.
How graphic is the violence and sex on some of these games?
It would blow your mind, actually. I like games, but sometimes it takes me a while to catch up and actually play all the games that are out there. And I recently played a couple games that I put in, and I have to say I was shocked. They were pretty violent. I think the main thing that people are worried about is not so much the violence that you see, but the violence that people can perpetrate. So they, you know, encourage you to sort of take violent acts, which I don't think in the long term is a good strategy for the industry to take. But these things are like pendulums, and I think we're kind of swinging back to sort of a more a less violent way of looking at things. I hope so.
All right. Well, we will see what happens with PlayStation 3 and subsequently when Nintendo gets up and running and Microsoft presumably not far behind. John Brody, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Analyst at GameSpot, computer and video gaming website. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Radziner and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Phoebe Zimmerman. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com. Just click on News. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.